Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin DNR. Preventing food waste and composting scraps and uneaten veggies, grains, and fruit can help the environment. More dnr.wi.gov by searching food waste.
Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at how the way we watch movies has changed and how that might be changing the movies.
First, we're talking about why Americans aren't healthier. A new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows that 200,000 deaths could be prevented each year if people just took better care of themselves, like eating more healthy foods, getting more exercise, and having better access to preventive health care.
No one in our office was too surprised by these numbers. There's a general sense that a lot of us could lead healthier lives. So why don't we change? Our guest is Dr. Patrick Remington, professor and associate dean at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Patrick, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, 200,000 preventable deaths from heart disease. Were you surprised to hear that?
Well, I was. It seemed like a big number. So when you look at the report that the CDC released, they have an interesting definition of avoidable in that they count all deaths that occur from heart disease, basically heart attacks, under the age of 75 as potentially avoidable. So about 800,000 people die each year in this country from heart disease, and about 200,000, the number reported today, of those people are under 75. And so I think it's, on the one hand, interesting that they call any death by a heart attack under the age of 75 avoidable. But on the other hand, that's good news, which means that we really should be able to, with proper lifestyle and prevention, but also good medical care, prevent nearly every heart attack death in this country under the age of 75.
Well, let's tackle that lifestyle issue first. This isn't a lack of knowledge problem. For the most part, I think we know what's good for us, what isn't. Why don't we make changes?
Well, think back about the 1960s when the Surgeon General told us that smoking was harmful to your health. The Great American Smokeout began, and people found it hard to quit. Just knowing that smoking was bad for you wasn't good enough. 30, 40 years later, when clean indoor air policies were enacted, prices were raised with excise taxes, media campaigns were focused on kids with school health education, and doctors helped their patients quit. Finally, once you had all the systems and services in place, it was easier to see smoking rates decline. And I think that same thing can be said about eating right and exercising. We know what we should do, but in today's environment, it's just harder to get the exercise you need to when you basically sit on your seat all day long working on your computer, and food is available everywhere. High-calorie, high-caloric density food is available nearly everywhere you go.
So it sounds like you're saying we didn't leave smoking to individual initiative only. We changed the environment that made it easier to quit smoking. What can we do to make similar changes in the two things you just mentioned, getting exercise and eating better?
Well, it's a good example. I mean, the person who is successful in quitting smoking finally makes the decision to quit. So there is an important individual responsibility. But people who have decided to eat right and exercise find it easier to do that when they live in a community that might have designed sidewalks, safe and walkable paths. This complete streets ordinance is a way to design streets that are not just designed for cars, but for bikes and pedestrians. So that if you design the community so that, I like to think of it as making the healthy choice the easier choice or the default choice. Same thing with food. You can go into a cafeteria and see all the unhealthy food right away and low-priced. Unhealthy food, junk food, fast food tends to be less expensive and more readily available. But if we flip that and made the healthy choices the first option and even subsidize those by taxing less healthy foods, we could see people making better decisions.
But who does that come from? It took a long time to get the smoking regulations and laws you mentioned into place. Are grocery stores, are cafeterias going to do these things voluntarily, or is it going to take some sort of government initiative to do this?
Well, I think it takes both. Government doesn't just operate on its own. It represents the interests of the people. And so eventually people got tired of breathing the smoke from someone else's cigarettes. People supported smoke-free restaurants and then smoke-free bars and finally smoke-free workplaces. I think the same will happen with designing healthier communities. It takes a little longer to think about designing a sidewalk or even building a building, but those changes will come as people understand how our environment helps shape our behaviors. And so people are getting involved. A new building here on campus, the School of Human Ecology. When you walk in, the stairs are the first thing you see. It used to be the elevator would be the first thing, and then you'd have to find the stairways. And now we've flipped the design of buildings so that the healthy choice, taking the stairs for one or two flights, is the easier choice. And there's still elevators for people who need it, but the stairs and healthy choices are easier to do and then more likely to be done.
Here's a comment from Jerry on Facebook. Jerry writes, "Yes, everyone has to eat, but that does not mean we should live in a culture where people are allowed to push combinations of sugar, fat, and salt, which are addictive." So he writes that we've heard a lot about how addictive fast food, bad food, junk food can be. Do you think corporations, the food companies, are to blame for part of the food and diet problem in this country?
Well, again, corporations market products to individuals based on demand. People demand fast food. So it's not either or. We need to get people to begin demanding healthier foods so that the marketplace can respond. But I also think there should be limits, particularly on what we serve our kids, that unhealthy school lunch programs should be a thing of the past. We should really reduce options for kids. Kids, when presented with healthy foods as the only option, eat healthy foods. And so I agree with the comment that industry is responding to the demand. And when you watch television and see sort of the fast foods being advertised, you wonder who's buying them, but a tremendously large part of the population still eats fast foods and relies on relatively unhealthy foods.
You mentioned in the CDC report on preventable heart disease death mentions access to health care. How does that help prevent deaths over the long haul from cardiac issues?
Well, it turns out that cardiac disease can not only be prevented, but once someone has heart disease, that taking an aspirin or having your blood pressure controlled or even being treated after a heart attack is very effective. It's interesting to notice that over the past 10 years, the number of deaths from people 65 to 74 years of age has gone down. That's an age when people have Medicare and universal access. We have a single-payer government finance healthcare system called Medicare, and that we've continued to see progress. There's been no decrease in heart disease deaths for people under the age of 65, and many of those individuals are either underinsured or uninsured. And so that's a good evidence that having health insurance and having access to good quality medical care may be preventing deaths that aren't preventable when people don't have access to care.
Maybe a related issue, that CDC report pointed out some major racial differences. African Americans, for example, twice as likely to die from avoidable heart disease or stroke, meaning at an earlier age, than white Americans. Why is this?
Well, it's a combination of things. African Americans tend to have less access to health care, but also social and economic challenges that lead to higher risk factors, less healthy diets, for example, and even higher smoking rates. Rates are also higher in the southern and the eastern parts of this country. So it's related to culture and diet, but it's also related to social and economic factors. And those rates have been twice as high for a long time. We're seeing progress in all races and ethnic groups, but that gap continues to persist.
When we called you up about this study earlier, I think you used the phrase toxic environment to describe our current state of affairs when it comes to exercise and getting good food. Are you optimistic that we can, detoxify that environment and cut back more on those heart attack deaths?
Well, 100 years ago, when public health made major advances improving water and air quality, it used an environmental approach and reduced the toxins. And really today, you can consider it toxic with respect to healthy lifestyles, that the fast food environment, the difficulty that people have in finding safe places to exercise or just getting away from the computer. And so in a way, these environmental changes help us put, you know, what a doctor recommends into practice. They take time, but I think it's part of a comprehensive approach, and it really is fundamentally a public health approach, so that we create those conditions where people live, work, and play so that they can lead healthy lives, so that they can really put into practice what the doctor recommends.
Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Patrick Remington, professor and associate dean at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health.
Coming up next, we're talking to a film writer about how the way we watch movies has drastically changed over the years. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. You're listening to Central Time.
It used to be audiences trotted off to the theater to see movies in style on the big screen, but today watching a movie at home can be just as comfortable with loads of options for what to watch, too. And our guest today says the way we watch movies has changed, but the way we talk about movies hasn't quite caught up yet.
Keith Phipps joins us now. He's editorial director at The Dissolve Magazine, a new online publication dedicated to film. Keith, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, things changed a lot since I was a kid. You know, we went to the theater to see a movie. Eventually, those VCRs came along and started to change things. How would you describe what's happened since then?
Well, I think things have changed a lot, really, in the last couple of years. I mean, VCRs were huge in terms of, you know, opening up the possibility for watching older films at home, and DVD just improved that process even more. But more and more, you're seeing a lot of films that are released on demand before they're in theaters, or at the same time as they're in theaters. And even with a lot of smaller releases, the gap between, even if it plays theaters first, the gap between theatrical run and a home video release to DVD, Blu-ray, and streaming services is pretty narrow. So if you miss something in the theater, you can be pretty confident you can catch up with it again pretty soon. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it seems to be kind of changing the basic dynamic of going to the movies.
Well, let's elaborate on that a little bit about the basic dynamic of going to the movies. So is it safe to say that going to the theater is not really the primary way of taking in a movie anymore?
Well, I wouldn't say that, and I hope that's never the case, because that's still my primary way. I love seeing, the way I most love seeing movies is seen in the theater. But I mean, with so much out there and with so many options to sit at home, and with basic inertia being part of the factor, and with TV screens getting bigger and bigger, staying at home seems like a more and more viable option. And it's also cheaper, and that's certainly something to consider as well. So, a lot of stuff is coming home. I forget which cinematographer it is, but there's a documentary called Side by Side, which is produced and narrated by Keanu Reeves. It's kind of about the changing face of digital filmmaking, and it's there's a cinematographer that says that, you know, he rarely goes to the movies anymore because his TV is large enough that it doesn't really bother him that much, and the projection on the TV screen is close enough to what you get in a movie theater. And I think a lot more people are making that call as well, that it's, you know, staying home might be good enough if it's too much of a hassle to go out.
Well, with so much out there available, it's hard to sift and winnow sometimes. And I know I categorize movies sometimes as saying, all right, that one is something I need to see on the big screen because it's going to lose, you know, special effects extravaganza or something, versus a real talkie movie. I can wait and watch that on the smaller screen later. Are you doing something similar?
I would love to say that you're doing it absolutely wrong, and I would never think of it that way. I think of it in exactly the same terms. You know, if I'm going to see Iron Man 3, I probably prefer to see that on the big screen because things are going to blow up in spectacular fashion. It may not be my favorite film of the year. I've seen it. It's not my favorite film of the year, but it's one I'd prefer to see, you know, given the choice, like to see on the big screen. I think people like us are part of the problem in a way because movies are meant to be seen in movie theaters, but things changing as they are, we may as well talk about the best possible way to see them and to see as many quality movies as you can.
How do you think filmmakers are responding to the changing way that films are being viewed? I mean, is it by and large seen as a good thing, or is that too narrow a focus?
So I think I think by and large, people are trying to ignore it as much as possible. we talked to the cinematographer of a film called Ain't Them Body Saints, which I think we were going to talk about a little bit later. It's a film I highly recommend. And he talked about all the effects that went on to capturing the look of the film, which is a wonderful-looking film. And our interviewer confessed that he'd watched it on DVD on his laptop. And, he was a little bit – I think the cinematographer was – his name is Bradford Young – was a little taken aback, but also kind of understood this is how a lot of movies get watched these days.
What do we lose when even if we have a pretty good kick-butt TV system at home, what do we lose by not taking it into the theater?
Well, you lose the scale, and you lose the immersion factor, too. There's so many distractions at home. I mean, I know I'm a lot more receptive to something that's slower and meditative in a theater when there's no option of getting up and getting a cup of coffee or whatever, but there's always a laptop nearby. I mean, you check your email very quickly. It won't distract from the movie, right? But it really does. I mean, I'm not a fan of the second screen experience. I really feel like movies are meant to be focused on and watched. That said, I'm as fallible as anybody else when it comes to distractions. That also being said, I feel like we're kind of in a bad cycle, too, where people are kind of getting used to watching things at home and chatting and checking their email, and you go to the theater, and you're not necessarily guaranteed the best possible experience because people don't really always know how to behave in theaters anymore.
Do you feel like Hollywood might be trying to lure us back to the big screen? There's been a glut of 3D movies, plots that are pretty simple and easy to follow, even if you're, you know, wanting to be a little more easily distracted, as we hear about attention spans shrinking. And then, like, snacks. And in Madison, where the show is based, snacks have gotten kind of sophisticated. It's not just popcorn anymore. Do you think that the film industry is trying to step it up?
Yeah, I think there is that as well. And 3D... there's sort of the debate as to whether or not audiences really want it or if it's really kind of a surcharge to make up some lost income. But I think, again, you kind of get into the different variation on another cycle that we've been talking about, where if people are only going to go see big special effects-driven films, that's mostly what you're going to get, and that's kind of what happened this summer. I mean, it's more complicated than that, and fall tends to bring, a crop of more thoughtful films, but nonetheless, a lot of what you see in the theater will be geared to that bigger screen.
One big stumbling block is the cost of that movie ticket and the cost of that popcorn or whatever fancy snack. Mm-hmm. Do you think people are just looking at and saying, hey, I can stream a whole lot of movies for the same price that I'd pay to go to see one movie?
Yeah, there's absolutely that, I get to see a lot of films in the course of my job, but not as many as I want to, and certainly my wife is also a fan of films, but when we look at the cost of going out, and we have a 2-year-old and getting a babysitter and all this, it really does start to add up to the point where you feel like you really need to get an experience you're not going to get at home to get out of the house.
Do you think that, you know, you talked about earlier about filmmakers ignoring how we're changing our movie watching experience. Are they doing that at their own peril and letting, you know, smaller things like TV shows get a foothold?
Well, I think filmmakers probably are best to ignore the many different ways a film is watched and really try to make the best film possible, the best looking film possible. And I think it's kind of up for technology to catch up with that. I think that's the smartest thing. I think if you really try to alter what you're doing to fit the many possibilities for it, you're going to run into trouble.
Yeah, because then you'd be trying to cover everything from a small laptop screen up to the ultra screen and all points in between. And I get that's got to be a cinematographer's nightmare.
Yeah, exactly. And it's certainly, it's not unprecedented either. I mean, Sergio Leone, who directed Good, the Bad, and the Ugly and all the great spaghetti westerns in the 60s, he made his last film, Once Upon a Time in America. He did not shoot it in CinemaScope because he hated the way his films looked on television. And he assumed that if people were going to be watching his film years down the line, it would be on the old scale television. So that's part of the reason why he shot that film in a different aspect ratio.
What are the silver linings for filmmakers here? I'm guessing that the fact that a film could kind of live forever online now has got to change the way films get watched and stored in our collective memory.
Yeah, there are huge silver linings. There's the fact that an art house film that would, once open in New York and Los Angeles, and slowly make its way to secondary and tertiary markets. I know when I lived in Madison, I waited forever for some films to show up. A lot of them can be available instantly on demand, and if you're okay with watching at home, that's your choices. Really open up at that point. And I think you can, this is something we're trying to address on the site, is if something's on demand, it has a national audience right away. So if people are watching and people are talking about it, it can become more of a national conversation rather than a local conversation as films move from place to place. So yeah, there's a lot easier to get seen. It's a lot easier for films to stick around. I'm not sure. And it's again something we tried to address on the site. I'm not really sure that the way we talk about films has caught up with that, in the sense that on demand almost feels like, so when something comes on demand before it comes in theaters, it almost feels like it's in this twilight zone where it doesn't really quite exist yet. I mean,
we'll pick up Keith. We'll pick up that point after the news. We're talking with Keith Phipps about how movie watching has changed over the years, and we'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you done with theaters, or do you think nothing can replace the big screen experience? 800-642-1234.
This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rigger. We're picking up our conversation with Keith Phipps, editorial director at The Dissolve, a new online film magazine. And we're talking about the way movie watching has changed over the years. And we want to know your take on this. How has your movie watching habit changed? Do you think the Cineplex still matters? Do you still go out to a movie and spring for popcorn and have an experience on the big screen? Or does that matter less to you than it used to? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll get to your calls in just a moment, but Keith, before we do that, let's pick up that point you were talking about. Movies have changed, but the way we talk about them hasn't. What do you mean by that?
Oh, actually, more to the point, we haven't really caught up. Mm. I think a lot of people haven't caught up with the changes in film, particularly with on-demand. It seems like when a film comes out and it's available on-demand before it's available in theaters, it's almost like in this weird twilight zone where people can watch it, but it's almost like people aren't talking about it yet. We're kind of running into this, not to get too inside baseball, but we're kind of running into the strange thing where sometimes people are eager to have their films reviewed by us as soon as anyone can see them anywhere, whereas others are reluctant to make them available until they're shown theatrically, even though they're, you know, we can buy them ourselves and watch them with just a push of a button. It's very odd. Like when the new Brian De Palma film Passion came out, it was on demand, I think, about 6 weeks ago. We wrote about it then. We interviewed him, and then when it played theaters, people just started, you know, started to see profiles of De Palma in places like New York Times, almost as if this were the debut. It's just like what happened before didn't quite count. So I think people are still catching up in that way.
What do you think is the benefit of a filmmaker for having their movie open on demand instead of, you know, at a theater?
I think people are still in the process of figuring that out, honestly. I don't know if it hurts attendance at theaters or if it helps it. My instinct would be that it helps build word of mouth, and if a really terrific movie debuts on demand, its audience will only build when it plays elsewhere. But I don't know. I'm not sure there's any numbers to back that up yet. I think it's such a new practice that people haven't quite figured out the rules yet.
Well, one of the things we're going to talk about this hour is a movie that you loved recently, because this is your primary job, writing about movies. And this movie is called Ain't Them Body Saints. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's the second film from director David Lowery, who's also an editor. He worked on a film called Upstream Color that came out earlier this year. And it is very much conscious of 1970s films, particularly Robert Altman and Terrence Malick. It's a gorgeous-looking film that's sort of about a pair of lovers on the land, but not really. It's not really a Badlands or a Thieves Like Us situation. It's about these two criminals played by Rooney Mara and Casey Affleck, but it kind of starts the story where a lot of these films end. One of them is Casey Affleck is arrested and sent to prison, and Rooney Mara stays behind. And it's about his attempts to reunite with her, but it's also sort of this slow, meditative look at how people change over time and how love can kind of fade away under certain circumstances. And it's set sometime in the late 60s, mid-70s in Texas, and it has, it is, as I was saying before, just sort of a extremely gorgeous-looking film that needs to be seen on the big screen, unless, like me, you watched it on DVD because it was easier.
All right, well, let's listen to a little bit of clip from that.
I know you know I'm out, and I hope you know I'm coming for you. Just like I always said.
Short clip there from the trailer for Ain't Them Body Saints. Now, this is a movie that you write about in The Dissolve as making beautiful use of the golden hour, even though you watched it on DVD. Mm-hmm. Can you describe the look of it a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it, like Terrence Malick's Days of Heaven, a lot of it seems to be shot at sunset or sunrise, so the magic hour when the light is sort of perfect for shooting films. And there's ways to fake that, and I believe that they've done that a little bit, but it gives that impression of it being kind of shot in this perpetual twilight, and it's sort of beautiful looking that way. But it also is really great with the way it shoots interior sequences, with like sort of this really deep shadows and piercing bits of light. I mean, it is truly the work of someone who knows what he wants to put up on the screen. And I really expect to see many more interesting films from David Lowery.
That sounds interesting. Mentioning DVDs reminded me of something I wanted to bring up that's been nagging at me some as I watch more and more streaming and less DVD. When I buy the DVD or borrow it from the library, there are those extras, the directors talking over the movie or the, you know, behind the scenes things. Streaming, it's gone. Has the age of that kind of background material come and gone, do you think?
I hope not. I feel like we're also in a transitional period there, too, where I think physical media is going to be more of a fetish item. Like I love my Blu-rays, and I buy Blu-rays of films I like, but I'm not sure I'm in the majority there anymore. I actually still prefer the way a Blu-ray looks to the best streaming I've seen, but streaming's just going to get better, and I'm going to assume that in the long run, people are going to want those special features again. Certainly for the discs that have already been produced. I mean, there are many wonderful features and commentary tracks that it would be a shame if they just got lost or relegated to the collector's bin. I don't know if the economy will ever be there to produce those kind of features. Again, for a while, DVDs were extremely profitable, allowing studios to do sort of these luxurious special features, and that's not the case anymore. And until there's a demand for it on streaming, I'm not sure it'll be the case again, but I certainly hope so. That was a really, I guess we didn't realize we were kind of in the golden age of special features for much of the 2000s there.
What did we gain from having those? Did they actually give us something useful behind the movie, or was it just it felt obligatory to have that thing on there because everybody else had them?
I think there's a little bit of that. I think that there's a lot of really slow and lazy director's commentary. Because it became obvious the director's commentaries were a big selling point. But when it's done right, I find it hugely illuminating. Like, I just reviewed the La Caja Folf. There's a new Criterion edition of that out. And the background in writing my review and just in general for appreciating the film, even if I were watching it as a non-professional, the supplementary material on that disc was invaluable.
Yeah, I've actually heard about people who say skip film school. You can just watch the director's commentaries.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's true or not. It probably depends upon the cut, but yeah, there's
something. Well, I think there's probably things that involved in picking up the camera that you'll never learn from a director's commentary, but I know it goes a long way.
Well, I know that you're a fan of going to the actual theater and sitting down minus all the distractions, but do you think that there might be a certain inevitability about home movies getting better as, you know, the big theatrical releases getting weaker?
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways we're already there in terms of the home viewing screens, home viewing situations getting better and better in home theaters. But I don't know. I would like to stay optimistic about theaters, that people still enjoy the experience of going out as much as I do, and that that's going to be with us for another century or so at least.
One thing I notice when I go to the theater is that the theaters themselves are kind of rethinking what they are. and you're seeing ads for not just movies anymore, but coming up with the digital technology. Live concerts will be screened at movies, or some national public radio shows show up doing live versions that you can go to a theater and watch. Is the theater going to change from a place where we see movies to a place where we see a lot of different things on a big screen?
I think it already has to some degree. Like, to what you're talking about, it happens all the time, and it seems to be quite successful. And I think that's fine. I think it keeps the whole theatrical operation viable. And I think it's interesting. And one thing I don't know if it's the case in your theaters, but one of the theaters does here is to do sort of a monthly series of classic films on Wednesdays, and it's great to see, you know, be able to go and see something like The Godfather Part II screened. True, it's digital projection, and then that's a whole other snobbish topic to another time. But still, it's a good thing to see on the big screen.
Well, Keith, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
That was Keith Phipps, editorial director at The Dissolve, a new online magazine dedicated to film.
Coming up, our next guest says iron cookware is still around, and it's still around for a good reason. You're listening to Central Time here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time.
Noah Ovshinsky is probably best known around here as WPR's assistant news director, but if you had to single him out for something after that, you probably have to call him a diehard foodie. And one thing he's passionate about is his cookware. That's cast iron cookware, to be precise. Noah, thanks for being here on Central Time.
It is a pleasure to be here to talk about cast iron.
I had a feeling you'd talk about cast iron anywhere.
Oh, yeah. It's a great bar conversation.
Well, you have, obviously, deep, passionate feelings about your cast iron cookware.
I do.
How come?
For a variety of reasons. When we talked about this segment, I made the joke that if there was ever a fire in my house, I would grab my wife in one hand, my cat in the other, and or at least under my hand, and then try to grab my cast iron skillet too, because it's just one of those things. There are a few things about cast iron skillets which I think set them apart from the other items that we have in our kitchen. One is, I can't think of a more versatile kitchen tool. This is a short list. I mean, really, your imagination is sort of the thing here. You can use it to shallow fry. You can saute. You can braise. You can bake. You can simmer. You can stir fry. You can sear. And you can even make bread in the thing and cook with it over a campfire, which you can't do with most of the stuff you got in your kitchen.
I could almost hear the soundtrack swelling under that list of beautiful reasons to cook with cast iron. But, you know, you did hit on one when you were talking about leaving your house in a fire. You talked about your cat and your wife and one skillet because they're so heavy, all you could take out is one. Don't you have to, you know, work out if you want to cook with cast iron? Stuff's heavy.
It is heavy. I recommend skillets, and I recommend actually the 12-inch comes with actually two handles. You've got the traditional handle and then another handle on the other side, and that makes it much easier to sort of negotiate around the kitchen. You know, one of the other things too, one of the reasons why I would take it with me, and one of the reasons why, in addition to its, you know, versatility, there's also something very romantic and old school about cast iron. You know, this is something that people have been using for a very long time. You know, explorers used, I mean, Lewis and Clark probably had cast iron skillets as they were making their way across this country. And there's also sort of this generational aspect to it. It's like cast iron is like jewelry or china or, you know, hunting shotguns or something. You know, if you treat it well, there is no reason why it can't last decades. And it's one of those things that often gets passed down from generation to generation.
So what about your cast iron cookware? Was it passed down to you, or did you had to go shell out money for a set?
It's funny you mention that. My mom actually lent me her cast iron skillet. This is the one that I used throughout my childhood. And for whatever reason, asked for it back. The seasoning on it was perfect. It was truly nonstick. She asked for it back, and I actually ended up getting a new skillet for Christmas about 6 years ago.
Do they get better with age then, when they're properly seasoned?
Yeah, when they're properly seasoned and, more importantly, properly cared for, they actually, like a wine, like a good wine, it actually gets better with age. The nonstick quality actually gets better the more you cook with it.
Really? Well, let's talk about the care and seasoning of it, because that's something that has always scared me personally off, because I know cast iron, you know, is fantastic for cooking, but then I really can never get a handle on the seasoning part. So how does that work?
Right. So if you buy a cast iron skillet now, chances are it will come pre-seasoned. That didn't used to be the case, but now it's pre-seasoned and you can pretty much just, you know, take it out of the package or pop it right in the oven and do whatever you want with it. That said, if you want to add to that season or after you use it for a while and you want to re-season it, there's one way that I like to do it. And I like to just take some vegetable oil in a paper towel, not much. And, you know, you just sort of wipe it around both inside and outside the skillet. You throw it in the oven, a very hot oven, something like, you know, 350, 400 degrees, which I guess is a medium temperature. You throw it in the oven and you let it sit there in the oven for an hour. And then you just leave it in there when you turn off the oven and just let it cool down with the oven. And it's best to have a cookie sheet or a foil or something under the cast iron skillet so that it catches the drippings, the oil. And of course, you put it in the oven upside down so that when when the inside does drip, it drips down and doesn't just sit there. And then what you have is a basically perfectly seasoned skillet.
So we talked about the seasoning of it, but you mentioned the care of it. So then how do I take care of it once I've got it seasoned?
Yes, and that's a good question. And this is about as much about like personal choice as anything, really, because people have different ways of taking care of their cast iron. Myself, I don't use soap. Some people do. I don't.
So you're telling me your pans are dirty?
No, they're not dirty. I just assume that at the temperatures in which I'm cooking with my cast iron skillet, chances are it's above 200 degrees, 212 degrees. Anything that's on there is going to be dead. That said, that's up for people's own choice and really their own sort of approach to hygiene. But I don't use soap. What I do is I will oftentimes, after I'm done cooking with it, put some water in it, put it back on the stove, let some of the water bubble away, and a lot of those chunks will sort of come up. And then I'll just lightly brush it, brush those chunks out with a paper towel. But whatever you do, don't use an abrasive sponge, and don't leave it out. Don't leave it out without having dried it first. When you go to store cast iron skillets or really cast iron implements of any nature, you want to make sure that when they are stored, they are dry, bone dry, and preferably re-oiled with a vegetable oil to keep that seasoning good.
Okay, so I'm getting lost in the care of it again.
I know. It's all worth it. Trust me, Veronica. It's worth it.
I'm with you.
You'll be rewarded with a beautiful piece of kitchen equipment.
Okay, so let's say you cook something in there.
Yes.
You've got like a pork chop in there.
Yeah, yes.
And then you're done. You eat said pork chop.
Yes.
And then you put water in it. Yeah. You let it bubble up.
Yeah.
And the chunks, as you beautifully put it, come up.
Yeah. And then you
let it cool down. And then you just wipe it out with some more oil?
Or paper towel. Yeah.
Paper towel and some more oil. That's it?
Yeah. If it's really sticking, I will take just a sponge, a non-abrasive sponge, and I'll lightly sort of, you know, clean it, you know, as carefully as I possibly can. But the number one priority, at least for me, is maintaining the seasoning, because that is a seasoning that most likely you've worked hard to create over the years, and you don't want to ruin it with, too much soap and certainly any abrasive sponges.
Okay, I think I got this. Now, a pan is no fun unless you cook stuff in it. What do you like to cook in your cast iron? What does it lend itself well to?
Anything. You know, I gave you the list. I mean, you can fry chicken, you can make cornbread. I mean, you can do any number of things. One of my favorite, and dare I say, sort of nostalgic recipes, and it was a recipe that I used my mom's cast iron skillet with when I was a kid, was a German pancake, which is a very easy and delicious breakfast recipe for cast iron skillets. Now, I can't say exactly where this recipe came from. It's in my family cookbook, but it's very simple. And a German pancake, again, is one of those things that chances are you have the ingredients in your pantry or your refrigerator, and you can put it together, and it's got a beautiful presentation, and it's delicious.
Well, tell us about what's in it. It sounds fantastic.
So real quick, you're going to take that oven, you're going to preheat it to 400 degrees, so relatively warm, and you're going to mix three ingredients, one cup of milk, one cup of flour, and four eggs. So it's a pretty egg-heavy dish. You're going to mix all that together. You're going to take the cast iron skillet separately. You're going to melt the original recipe called for 5 tablespoons. I don't know what.
No wonder it
was
good.
I don't know what my family was thinking, and I don't remember if that's what it was when I was a kid. Anyway, I've since cut that down over the years to 2, a very respectable
and it still works
and flavorful 2 tablespoons of butter in that cast iron skillet. And you want to warm it up on a stovetop and get it sizzling, and then you add the batter of milk, flour, and eggs, and you just stick it in the oven. And 13 minutes later, you've got this fluffy, beautiful breakfast. And, you know, really the toppings are endless. The traditional topping is just simply lemon juice and powdered sugar. Now, of course, when you add the lemon juice, it's the puffiness is going to come down a bit. So you want to make sure you present it to your guests or your family before you add the lemon juice so that they can, you know, see that they can behold the beauty of the German pancake.
So you want to show off your puff is
saying. Of course. Yeah. Who doesn't?
Well, that sounds lovely. And I have to say that recipe is very simple. If you didn't manage to jot it down, it is right now on the Central Time Facebook page, so you can catch it there as well. And aside from a delicious German pancake, what else do you cook in your skillet?
I'd say the other thing that really shines is roast chicken. And roast chicken is one of those things that seems simple on the surface, but is actually really difficult to do. And I've toyed with probably literally a dozen or more recipes over the course of my cooking life without having perfected a perfectly roast 3.5 pound chicken. And actually from Mark Bittman from the New York Times actually came out with a recipe using a cast iron skillet that makes a perfectly cooked chicken and roast chicken. And I've done it several times and it's worked every time. And basically the key to it is taking a cast iron skillet, putting it in the oven, very hot oven, 500 degrees. And you want to heat it up very hot, take it out and put that, say 3.5-4 pound chicken that you've either used butter or olive oil or vegetable oil, whatever you do to prep your own roast chicken, you put that on the very hot cast iron skillet. You put it in the oven, back in the oven at 500, cook it for about 15 minutes at 500, take the oven down after 15 minutes and cook it for another, say, half an hour at 325, 350. And by the end of that cooking period, you're going to have a perfectly cooked roast chicken. And what the cast iron skillet does is it helps you deal with one of the challenges, which is making sure that you have evenly cooked dark meat and white meat, because that's a very difficult thing to do. And by starting with a very hot cast iron skillet, you're going to make sure that that dark meat is cooked at the same rate as the white meat.
Why is that? I mean, I don't know if you're an expert in this, would cast iron do that instead of my anodized aluminum or my pan or whatever?
Well, because the cast iron can get so hot. I mean, very, very hot. And that helps that the meat that's at the bottom of the chicken cook evenly. And so, I mean, for my money on just the ability to make a perfectly roast chicken, that's worth the $30 that a 12-inch cast iron, I mean, to me, you know. And what's better than a fall night with a roast chicken in the oven? I mean, it literally tastes like the fall.
Just you, your pan, and the roast chicken.
Yeah,
sounds
it's excellent.
Nice.
And that's from Mark Bittman.
And here's somebody who agrees with you. Peter in La Crosse emails, "When I moved away from my parents' home at age 19, my dad walked up to me with a cast iron frying pan. I thought he was going to hit me with it. And he said, 'Here, you're going to need this,' and handed me the pan. And I still use that same pan today." So that's getting at
the generational
thing we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Well, I think you've inspired a lot of us to try out cast iron. Beautiful. Thank you, Noah.
Satisfaction guaranteed.
Really? Okay. And Noah's home phone number is... Nah, we won't go there. All right. Noah Ovshinsky joining us today talking cast iron. He's one of WPR's in-house foodies and assistant news director. Thanks so much, Noah.
Thanks.
No, I'm hungry. Thanks, guys. Coming up, we look at the culture of cheating in higher education. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.